Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If so, congratulations, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have tons of cool features like curated podcast playlists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but my brand new, members-only version of this show, called Morbidology Plus, is only available on the Himalaya app. When you become a member of Morbidology Plus, you'll get all ad-free, exclusive episodes where I'll be covering topics we normally leave out on my free episodes. You'll even get these episodes a full 4 days early. And the best part is, Morbidology Plus is available for just $4.99 a month. For all those reasons, Himalaya is the only listening app that I use, and I'm sure it'll be the only one for you too. So download Himalaya and go join Morbidology Plus today. Hey guys, before we get started with the show, I just have another little announcement to make. I'm always on the hunt for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of Morbidology, then I think Crime Lines will be right up your alley. Crime Lines walks you through true crime events, pairing captivating tales with clear storytelling. Host Charlie Worrell gives the most in-depth analysis by bringing in appropriate historic and cultural context to look beyond simply what happened and consider why it happened. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, complete with exclusive episodes, early access, and a members-only community group where you can chat with the host. Simply download the Himalaya app, search Crime Lines, and enter promo code CHARLIE, spelt C-H-A-R-L-I-E, for your first month, absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go check out Crime Lines. I love the show, and I think that you will too. Now on with the episode. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. In the grim lifestyles of homeless youths, instant and transitionary friendships are as routine as day and night. In the late 1980s in Sydney, New South Wales, a group of transient youngsters drifted in and out of each other's lives just as easily as they drifted around Sydney's streets and the city's rail system. Studies have indicated that a common characteristic of young violent offenders is the alienation from families, and often from the community as a whole. The displaced youngsters were all well known to police, but in 1988, they became well known to the world after committing one of the most violent crimes in Australian history. It was the 8th of September in 1988 in Sydney, New South Wales, when a group of teenagers attempted to abduct a young woman in the overflow car park outside Sutherland train station.
When I started to walk towards my car was one of the first, was the first car lined up along the car park. As I walked towards my car, I noticed there was this group of youths. So I thought, this looks a bit suspicious. I mean, not that I thought anything was going to happen, but, you know, when you get a group of kids, sometimes you just feel a bit threatened, I suppose. I sort of got my keys at the ready, thinking, you know, if something does happen, you know, I get my car quickly. I quickly got into my car and he walked up to my window and saw there was a flick knife held here. And I just went, oh my God.
Christine Moberly managed to get herself into her car and lock the door. She drove to Sutherland Police Station to report her terrifying ordeal. Police assured her that they would investigate. It was around 4:30 p.m. when Christine drove back past the Sutherland train station. While passing, she spotted the same group of teenagers, who by now had turned their attention onto somebody else. 20-year-old Janine Balding left her office in the city at around 4:30 p.m. to catch the train to Sutherland, where she had parked her car in the train station's overflow car park. She was planning on having a night out with her fiancé, Steve Moran. The couple had recently just purchased their very first house together in Berkeley Vale. Janine had moved to Sydney from Wagga Wagga around 4 years earlier to live with her older sister, Caroline, in a flat in Cronulla. Next, we will hear from Bev and Kerry, Janine's mother and father.
Always a bubbly little girl and stood up for herself well and truly as she was growing up, and she had a few little friends, not a lot, but a few little friends, and she was a loyal friend to anybody who made friends with her.
I remember in Canberra, she got stuck between two beds there once because she was always looking around, always crawling around. We used to go a lot away with Mum and Dad or Bev's Ma, you know, for weekends. She was the villain of the joy of the family.
She'd always be willing to help you out, you know, if you wanted to do something, and she'd offer to do things, which was, you know, a very nice attitude to have, you know. She left school in year 10 after completing her school certificate, and she dearly wanted to go to Sydney, and her elder sister was living in Sydney at the time, so we decided because the sister was in Sydney she could go too, but she had to have a job first.
It was here in Sydney that Janine met Stephen, a fireman. The duo were scheduled to get married on the 18th of March, 1989.
She was really looking forward to being a wife and a mother, yes, I'm sure she was. But she was very good with anyone that had little children. She had some friends that had little ones, and she used to love helping out there if she could. She was always very good with David too. She looked after him lots of times.
Janine had recently got a new job as a clerk at the George Street branch of the State Building Society. She was kind, thoughtful, and always smiling. Janine had chosen that job in particular because the Building Society offered their staff a good mortgage rate, and Janine and Stephen needed all of the help that they could get. Back at Sutherland train station, Christine looked on in horror as she witnessed the same group of teenagers that attempted to abduct her forced Janine into her own 1979 blue Gemini sedan car, which was parked outside the train station. The group consisted of four teenage boys, a teenage girl, and one of them was carrying a knife. Christine rushed back to the police station, but she was told to wait her turn before she could finally tell them that she had just witnessed an abduction. With a description of the teenagers involved in the abduction, police began the tedious task of attempting to identify them and track them down, as well as track down Janine. Time truly was of the essence. Janine had been abducted, and it wasn't known if she was safe or what the motivation behind the abduction was. Janine's 1979 blue Gemini sedan car was discovered abandoned on the Great Western Highway at Coylton near Mount Druitt. Next, we will hear from Sergeant Thomas Sharp.
And Detective Sergeant Dick Cornacki arrived. And when he had a look at it, he organised a little search around the area. And it was at that point that they start finding other things belonging to Janine Balding.
In the back seat, police found Janine's green skirt, underwear and her handbag.
And they said, we found Janine's car. I said, oh, I didn't know it was missing. But they said, we can't find Janine. I said, oh, she's got to be around, you know, somewhere. They said, the car was found at Penrith. As soon as they said that, the penny dropped. Janine wouldn't be out of there. She didn't go out like that.
He come back, walked through the doorway, and I knew by the look on his face something was wrong. I could just tell, you know, the look on his face.
Just the following day, 16-year-old Matthew Elliott and 14-year-old Bronson Blessington were arrested and charged in relation to the abduction. They had been at the Copam Youth Centre when a social worker called police after they began alluding to the fact that they had committed a crime. As Sergeant Thomas Sharp was arresting Elliott under suspicion of murder, Blessington blurted out, quote, "Do you want me to come too? I was with him," end quote. As they drove the teenagers to Penrith Station, Blessington said, quote, "Do you want this? I just had it on me. I thought you might want it," end quote, and handed one of the officers a yellow pocket knife, clearly showing their age and lack of comprehension about how much trouble they were in. On the way to the station, the teenagers chatted about football.
While I spoke to him, he told me that he wasn't sure whether she was dead, whether Janine was dead. And the first duty of mine is the preservation of life. And I asked him if he'd take me to the site where this happened. And he then took us to the dam at Minchinbury and took us right out where Janine was floating in the dam.
Later on that night, Elliot took Detective Sergeant Thomas Sharp to a dam at Minchinbury. He led the detective through barbed wire and fields before reaching the water. Here, he pointed towards Janine's body, face down in around 40 centimetres of water. She was tightly bound and gagged, and she was clasping a clump of water weed. She was nude except for a State Bank Building Society shirt. An autopsy concluded that Janine had been sexually assaulted and then forcibly drowned in the water. Next, we will hear from Detective Inspector Russell Oxford, describing the area that Janine was found.
You just mentioned, picture that the scene in a quite darkened park area off the roadway, off the M4 freeway. Here's his dam, and all of a sudden here's Janine's body floating in the water.
The murder was described as one of Sydney's most appalling killings. Some of the detectives who handled the Anita Cobby murder were called in to assist. Detective Sergeant Graham Rosette and Kevin Rao, who both worked on the Cobby case, said that they were, quote, "disgusted and appalled by the brutality of Janine's murder," end quote.
It was just such a dreadful shock to us. And of course I wanted to go and see her, make sure it was her. It was the first thing I wanted to do. I thought, I said to Kerry, we've got to go down to see her, make sure it is her.
They took us out there. They showed us the fence that they threw Janine over. That's where she broke her wrist, I think. Well, they broke her wrist when they threw her over the fence there.
The following day, 22-year-old Stephen Jamieson, 15-year-old Wayne Wilmot and 15-year-old Carol Arrow were also arrested and charged with Janine's murder. The arrests stunned the nation, not only because of the young age of the killers, but because it was soon announced that all of the killers were homeless and members of a railway graffiti gang. The so-called graffiti children started innocently enough around 5 years earlier, when children and teenagers began spray-painting murals and slogans on Sydney's trains. At the time, a number of criminologists and psychologists said that the youth should be given free artistic expression, and special railroad areas were set aside for them to continue their art. However, the murder of Janine shattered the harmless image of these seemingly artistic children and exposed the dark underbelly of the subculture. Police Senior Sergeant Colin Horn said that the murder was the first to be linked to the graffiti underworld, but said that the members were increasingly turning to crime. The gangs had names such as KCD for Kill, Crush, Destroy, BHS for Blacks Have Style, IBS for International Bomb Squad, and many others. They consisted mostly of transient teenagers who lived around Sydney's railroad sidings and even in the sewers. According to Horn, some even spoke their own language, which outsiders couldn't understand. Quote, What started as a relatively innocent activity has become the focus of gang culture, end quote, said Paul Wilson, Assistant Director of the Government Criminology Research Council. New South Wales Minister for Family and Community Service, Virginia Chadwick, announced that there would be need for tougher procedures for dealing with transient teenagers. The changes that she was suggesting would be based around a system of government-enforced detention. According to Chadwick, this would quell the problem of teenage violence. Quote, "What we now need is a capacity to keep very disturbed young people, who may not be offenders, in a structured and reasonably secure environment. An environment where they are not going to run away," end quote, she said. Chadwick said that there would be three stages of detention, depending on the severity of the teenager's problems. Stage 1 and 2 would be for the less disturbed teenagers, who would be allowed to leave the detention facility to attend school. Stage 3, however, would be for the seriously disturbed, and these teenagers would not be allowed out whatsoever. Quote, "They will be in a physically secure environment with a carefully structured program that will provide for counselling, psychological or psychiatric treatment, if necessary, and education," end quote, said Chadwick. Chadwick announced that she knew this proposal would divide the nation, but she said that she wasn't concerned. She said she was sick of the refuge merry-go-round, where violent children and teenagers were not receiving proper treatment simply because they refused to stay in refuges long enough and hopped from place to place. Other than Arrow, the gang were all well known to police. Blessington was the product of a broken home and had been convicted of stealing. Elliot came from a working class family, but had been convicted of arson, false pretenses, breaking and entering, and stealing cars. A psychiatrist said that Elliot was intellectually among the bottom 4% of the population. At just 5 years old, Will Mott had been made a ward of the court after his parents deemed him uncontrollable. As he grew up, he attempted to re-establish a relationship with his parents, but was rejected. By 15 years old, he had 13 convictions, including sexual assault, indecent assault, stealing and robbery. Jamison had convictions of sexual assault, indecent assault, malicious wounding and stealing. A psychiatrist said that Jamison had the mental age of a 10-year-old. When it was revealed about the earlier attempted abduction of Christine, there was an outcry by the public, who questioned why police didn't respond. The New South Wales Police Department ordered an immediate inquiry. Sergeant Wayne Thompson of Sutherland Police claimed that police did respond to the first report immediately, but said that Christine wasn't familiar with the area and gave them unclear directions as to where the attempted abduction took place. According to Thompson, police had gone to the wrong car park.
The police unfortunately went to the wrong car park. They went to the car park on the other side of the railway line.
There's a lot of car parks at Sutherland Station, as people who live down there know, but they did not go to where Christine had seen Jeanine, and I still feel, you know, it was a mistake on their part.
The police subsequently released a timeline of events leading up to the murder of Jeanine, which supposedly showed that even if they did go to the correct car park, then they would not have arrived in time to save her. According to police, there was a breakdown in communication between police and Christine, and police had been cleared of any wrongdoing by the Minister for Police, Mr. Ted Pickering. Quote, "It's very easy to be wise after the event. I don't think either side can be blamed in the light of the subsequent circumstances," end quote, he said. Shortly after the arrest of the group, Elliot, Blessington and Arrow were also charged with the earlier sledgehammer attack on an 18-year-old. Warren Purchase was attacked with a sledgehammer on the 6th of June at a derelict house in Flemington, where he had been squatting. Purchase had only arrived in the area from Victoria when he was attacked by the trio. They gagged him, tied him up and urinated on him. Following the attack, he was taken to Auburn District Hospital, where he remained in serious condition. Thankfully, Purchase survived the attack. The arrests led to a timeline of events that ended with the brutal murder of Jeanine. 22-year-old Jamison met 16-year-old Elliot and 14-year-old Blessington at a homeless shelter named The Station in the Sydney CBD just a mere hours before Janine was abducted. While chatting, Blessington had suggested, quote, "Why don't we get a Sheila and rape her?" End quote. They purchased a knife from the disposal store at Parramatta, and the five of them travelled from Central Railway Station to Sydney's southern suburbs. They had planned on approaching a woman who was getting into her car, threaten her with the knife, and then force her into her own car. Their first attempt failed when Christine managed to get into her car and lock the door. After they managed to bundle Janine into her own car, they drove her along the Great Western Highway to a dam at Minchinbury. 15-year-old Wilmot and his 15-year-old girlfriend, Arrow, were kissing and cuddling in the front seat of Janine's car as Wilmot drove to the dam. In an interview with police, he confessed that he had participated in the abduction and that he was the one who drove the car. In the back, the other males took turns in raping Janine. In a recorded interview, Wilmot told police, quote, "I didn't want sex with her. I had my own girl with me. They were doing it, not me. I didn't kill her and I didn't touch her," end quote. According to Blessington, Janine kept asking to be let out of the car at the next corner, but said that she didn't appear to be distressed. Quote, "She had a bit of a laugh sometimes," end quote, he said. According to Blessington, he didn't rape Janine. The oldest member of the group, Jamison, had a different recollection of that evening. He told police that Janine was very distressed and had begged them to let her go and said that she wouldn't tell anybody. He said that both Blessington and Elliot raped Janine and then threatened to stab her if she didn't give them oral sex. Quote, "She was screaming and telling them not to do it when they were touching her," end quote, said Jamison. Apparently one of the teenagers had reassured her that they weren't going to hurt her, while another was joking that it was a nice night for a murder. They forced Janine out of the car and held her down while she was raped on the grass by Blessington, Elliot and Jamison. She was gagged with a t-shirt and ropes were tied around her ankles, wrists and neck in a fetal position so that if she struggled to free herself, she would have choked. She was then pulled over a barbed wire fence into a paddock and then dragged around 100 metres to the edge of the dam. Here, she was held underwater until she drowned. After Janine was murdered, the group stole her jewellery and credit cards. They then used her credit cards to withdraw money and sold her jewellery. They also stole her car, but after having mechanical trouble, they abandoned it and walked to the Mount Druitt railway station, where they caught a train to the city. The day after the murder, two of the youths went to Gosford, where they discarded Janine's credit cards in a bush near the train station. Jamison initially claimed that he didn't rape Janine or participate in the murder, instead claiming he had handed the teenager some rope that was found in the trunk of her car and then remained at the car while they went down to the dam. However, when he discovered that police were going to give him a blood test, he changed his story. He claimed that he was afraid of needles before confessing that he had raped Janine, quote, "only once," end quote, on the grass beside her car. Jamison also told police that by the time they got to the grass near the dam, Janine had been raped so many times that she was, quote, "pretty worn out by now and wasn't screaming very much anymore," end quote. While each member of the group confessed to being present and participating to varying degrees, they all denied that they were involved in the murder and instead all blamed someone else.
The version they were giving was they were introducing all these other people and they were effectively talking in the third person. So in other words, what they were describing is what they did, and yet they're putting other people's names to it. So they're trying to really distance them from it.
Following the arrests, the Premier created a committee of key ministers that would produce urgent plans to target potential youth offenders. A ministerial committee headed by the Minister for Health, Mr. Collins, was set up to quickly review all government programmes for children under the age of 16 in an attempt to identify those that could potentially go on to commit serious and violent crimes. Collins announced that one of the proposals would be increased funding of the arts for young people. He also said that this could include offering government funds. The Minister for Police, Mr. Pickering, said that the incarceration of juveniles only led to re-offending. quote, "If we spend our money on courts and jails, we're going to lose the fight," end quote, he said. The formation of this committee came just as the government was preparing to introduce a package of measures that was designed to deal with young offenders. Under this new legislation, police were empowered to remove children under 16 years old from the streets and then place them under the care of the Department of Family and Community Services. According to Ken Burdham, the cases brought to juvenile courts had increased significantly. In the 12 months to June of 1987, more than 530 minors were charged with offences relating to drugs and weapons, 1,100 for serious assaults and 7,500 for stealing. As a result of the crimes committed by graffiti gangs, in the wake of Janine's murder, the State Rail Authority considered women-only coaches for late-night trains. In November, the group of killers appeared in court to see if there was enough evidence to warrant a trial. Martin Bonin, a company director, told the court that on the night of Janine's murder, 16-year-old Elliot had tried to sell him two of her gold rings. Bonin had met the teenager a year earlier at King's Cross Snooker Room. He said he was in Montreux railway station when he was approached by Elliot.
He told him that on the night that he saw him, when he sold him the ring, that he had mud on his legs and on his trousers and it was still like damp mud, it wasn't dry.
He said that the teenager looked unusually scruffy and that he was not wearing any shoes and had mud over his trousers, like he had, quote, been wading through something, end quote. Bonin told the courtroom that Elliot had told him, quote, "Four friends of mine have killed a girl by drowning her, but I'm not involved," end quote. Bonin told the court that he had taken one of the rings, which was an 18-carat yellow diamond solitaire. It was Janine's engagement ring. Under cross-examination, Bonin said he initially believed that Elliot was lying, quote, "because of previous stories told by him, none of which appeared to be true," end quote. After Bonin heard about Janine's murder on the news, he took the ring to the police station with his solicitor. The court also heard from a remand prisoner, known only as Witness A.
This prisoner came forward and said that he had nothing to hide, he was dying, and he wanted to get it out of his system, and he said that Jamieson did say that he killed Janine and he would do it again.
According to this witness, Jamieson had joked about killing Janine, telling him, quote, "I held her under the water, I did it and I'd do it again," end quote. The witness also said that Jamieson had bragged about raping Janine. At one point during the hearing, Jamieson was restrained and dragged from the courtroom after a violent outburst aimed at police. All five were committed for trial. At the time of Janine's murder, DNA testing was in its infancy. In March, it was announced that the first biological samples in New South Wales to be subjected to DNA profiling were being sent to the United Kingdom to undergo a new testing technique. The new technique was genetic fingerprinting, and the DNA from Janine's murder was one of the samples going to be tested. DNA testing subsequently showed that sperm found inside Janine matched the DNA of 14-year-old Blessington.
So that really tied him into the case, and even though he still had a litany of other lies where he continued to maintain that all these other people, and he had nothing to do with it, and yet here we are, we've got DNA that's tied him into this proof.
Dr. Gillian Rysecki, the manager of laboratory services with Cellmark Diagnostics, said that there was a 1 in 14 million chance that the sperm found inside Janine could belong to somebody else. It was ordered that Elliot, Blessington and Jamieson stand trial together for the murder, while Arrow and Wilmot stand trial together. It had been determined that Arrow and Wilmot didn't participate in the actual murder and had just sat in the car kissing and cuddling as the murder took place. Furthermore, Arrow's lawyer, Kate Gritching, had argued that her client was practically illiterate and intellectually disabled. She argued that her client couldn't quite comprehend what was happening. In front of the Supreme Court, Arrow's mother said that her daughter was a quiet and shy girl who had never been in trouble before. She said that she always helped around the house and loved children, but had ran away from home around 14 months before Janine was murdered. Justice Wood said that she considered this an exceptional case and granted Arrow bail. Their trial was slated for January of 1990, while the trial of the three other defendants was slated for September of 1989. Elliot, Blessington and Jamieson were facing charges of abduction, sexual assault and murder, and they all pleaded not guilty. Bev and Kerry would attend the trial every single day.
I was determined I'd go. I wanted to know what happened, because Janine was the type of person that would come home and tell me everything that happened to her in her day-to-day life. And that was one of the reasons why I felt, now I've got to know everything that happened. No matter how gruesome, I need to know. I think my first initial thought was how young they were. I was just shocked to think that young kids that age could do what they did to Janine. I just could not believe, that young boys would be doing the things that they did to her.
One of the first witnesses to testify was Jill Suzor, a shop assistant who worked in an army disposal store. She had testified that Elliot and Blessington had purchased a yellow-handled knife shortly before Janine's murder. While she had identified one of the youths from a police photograph, in the courtroom she was unable to point them out. Quote, "They are a lot tidier now than when I saw them. They had much longer hair. They all look different now," end quote, she said. She said that while in the store, they had considered purchasing a larger knife, but then opted for the smaller one. Senior Constable Jeffrey Thomas Smith, a fingerprint expert, testified that he had identified Elliot's fingerprints on the larger knife. On the second day of trial, Diane Adams took to the stand. Adams was a street kid who was lurking around Hyde Park last year when she became party to a very gruesome secret. It was in the early morning hours when Blessington and Elliot confided in her that they had kidnapped a woman, raped her and killed her. They showed Adams the yellow-handled knife and said they had held it against Janine's throat in order for her to do what they asked. Quote, "You would not believe what we have just done. We bumped this girl off over in Minchinbury and took her credit cards and car," end quote, they confessed to Adams. Apparently, Elliot told Adams that they had killed Janine because they were worried that she would go to police after they abducted her and raped her. Under cross-examination by Kevin Curry, Jamieson's defence lawyer, Adams denied that she fabricated the confession in a bid to protect her friend, Elizabeth Lopez, who was with her when the teenagers apparently confessed. See, Lopez had earlier told police that she was a witness to the murder, but it was later uncovered that she wasn't in the area when the murder took place, and the charges against her had been dropped. John Jordan, the defence lawyer for Elliot, also suggested that the conversation in Hyde Park never happened, but Adams denied these suggestions. Witness A also took to the stand once again to recollect what Jamieson had said to him while they were both in the remand section of Long Bay. Under cross-examination from Ted O'Loughlin, QC counsel for Jamieson, Witness A confirmed that he was serving a sentence for sexually assaulting children. When questioned about his charge, Jamieson started laughing in the dock. Witness A denied that he had made a deal with police officers, wherein false information was given to a district court judge that would be hearing his case in return for being a witness. Quote, "I even told the authorities I did not want to be released without having found a cure for me," end quote, he said. While on the witness box, Christine Moberly cried as she recollected how she had been approached by a group of teenagers at the Sutherland train station shortly before Janine was abducted. She recalled that one teenager had a yellow-handled knife and that she had managed to get into her car and drive away. Moberly identified the yellow-handled knife, which the Crown alleged the group had used during Janine's abduction, as the one she had seen the teenager holding. The trial was the first time that DNA results had been used as evidence in New South Wales. Under cross-examination by Kevin Curry, Dr. Gillian Rysek said that DNA testing had been criticised in a case in the United States, but said that the method she was using was different than the one used in the United States. When Blessington took to the stand, he made the explosive claim that Jamieson wasn't there when the crime was committed. Jamieson was nicknamed Shorty, and Blessington was now alleging that it was another shorty who had participated in the abduction, rape and murder of Janine. Blessington told the courtroom that he, Elliot, Wilmot, Arrow and another man named Shorty went to Sutherland Station that afternoon. Blessington claimed that when they got to the dam, Shorty told him to go for a walk. He said that when he returned, he saw Elliot and Shorty dragging Janine across a fence. He relayed to the courtroom that when they returned without Janine, Elliot said she had been drowned, while Shorty said she had been tied to a tree. From the dock, Elliot denied raping or killing Janine. According to him, he only drove the car after Janine was forced into it by Shorty. Elliot was now claiming that when they arrived at the dam, Shorty told both him and Blessington to, quote, piss off for a minute, end quote. Jamieson too claimed that he wasn't involved, and his lawyer, Ted O'Loughlin, said that the police case was tainted with malice towards Jamieson. According to Jamieson, on the evening of Janine's murder, he had been drinking in a hotel. Jamieson said that police had threatened to smash his head through a wall if he did not tell them what happened to Janine. While police contended that Jamieson had confessed to the murder, Jamieson denied it, claiming he told the detectives that he knew nothing about Janine's murder. He said the police had not asked him any of the questions that appeared in the record of the interviews with police. Shortly after the claims that Jamieson was not involved, the trial was aborted. With the startling testimony from Blessington, police reopened the investigation and found a man who matched the description of the man named Shorty that Blessington had claimed was the real killer. His name was Mark Wells. Before dismissing the jury, Justice Wood told them, quote, "It is most important that justice be done and that this matter not be put before a jury before all other avenues have been investigated," end quote.
The extraordinary claim comes after 3 weeks of evidence and despite the fact that the three young men have been sitting together in the dock every day.
We feel very much for the Baldwin family and they're going to
think it's
absolutely horrified.
After the trial was aborted so that further investigation could take place, Justice Wood announced that Arrow should get to spend Christmas with her family. Arrow had spent 1 year in custody on remand, which was equivalent to a 19-month jail sentence. Justice Wood said that Arrow was intellectually disabled and had a powerful desire to be accepted by her peers. A psychologist had determined that Arrow couldn't comprehend the severity of the crime, despite the fact that she had told police that during the attack, she feared for her own life. According to her counsel, Tim Game, Arrow had since suffered from depression and had flashbacks about the murder. Justice Wood determined that Arrow did not have an active role in the slaying and that he did not want her to go back to custody because it would be inhumane and counterproductive to her rehabilitation. Her sentence was deferred after she agreed to be of good behaviour for 3 years. Several months later, Wilmot, who had been scheduled to stand trial with Arrow, pleaded guilty to the abduction and sexual assault of Janine. In the Supreme Court, Justice Wood questioned how Wilmot had been released over and over again after committing numerous crimes as a teenager. He had been prosecuted 13 times before turning 15 years old. Quote, "For serious offences, he gets committed to an institution and then a month later he's back on the streets doing the same thing," end quote, said Justice Wood. After pleading guilty, Wilmot was sentenced for a minimum of 7 years. But the following month, he momentarily escaped police custody, adding another 6 months to his sentence. In May of 1990, Elliot, Blessington and Jamieson were facing trial once again. While investigators had found another man by the name Shorty that matched the description of the Shorty that Blessington claimed participated in the murder, they couldn't find enough evidence against him. With Jamieson, however, they had an apparent confession. The first witness was Stephen Moran, Janine's fiancé. He identified Janine's engagement ring, which Elliot had sold to Martin Bonin. He also identified her watch and her car keys. The second witness was Senior Constable Pearson, who worked in the physical evidence section. He testified that he had examined Janine's car and found her green skirt, which was part of her State Building Society uniform. Following his testimony, the courtroom was shown graphic photographs of Janine's bound body. During Elliot's testimony, he denied that he had raped Janine because he, quote, felt sorry for the lady, end quote. When Kevin Curry, Blessington's defense lawyer, asked why, if he felt compassion for Janine, didn't attempt to save her when she was being drowned, quote, the others might turn on me, end quote, he replied. Once again, Elliot said that Jamison wasn't involved in the abduction and murder, and once again said that Mark Wells was the guilty shorty. According to Elliot, it was Wells who drowned Janine. When cross-examined by prosecutor Mr. Bill Job, Elliot admitted that when he was first interviewed by police, he made up a man named Scott and claimed that it was Scott who had abducted and killed Janine. If he had lied early on in the investigation, why should they believe him now, he questioned. The jury was told that there were 51 people on the suspect list who went by the name Shorty. There were 6 witnesses at the trial who had either seen the group of youths on the train to Sutherland or later in the Mountruitt shopping centre where they had used the cash machine. One by one they were called into the courtroom and asked if they could identify Wells as one of the group. None of them could. One of the most memorable moments of the trial was when Mark Wells took the stand. Wells, who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, told the courtroom that his hobby was devil worship and claimed that when he was 15 years old, he killed a priest by nailing him to the wall. Next, we will hear from Janet Fide Yeomans, author of the Janine Balding story.
They discovered that Wells had a lot of mental problems. He was a self-confessed devil worshipper who thought the devil sat on one of his shoulders and spoke to him.
While Wells had claimed that he killed a priest, it had already been determined that this was complete fabrication. He told the Supreme Court that he heard voices telling him to kill and that before coming to trial, he had got his Ouija board out. Much like the others, Wells was a drifter and was acquainted with the suspects. Wells said he knew about Janine's murder, but said that he had dreamt about it and was not involved. He said that when Janine was abducted and killed, he had been at the station, which was a drop-in centre for homeless people, at Wynard, and then at the Matthew Talbot Hostel. Following his testimony, Wells told the court that he had to leave because he had to make a parachute jump. The DNA evidence was a big portion of the trial. While Blessington denied he raped Janine, DNA evidence was presented which showed that his DNA matched the semen found inside Janine. On the 23rd of June 1993, Stephen Jamison, Matthew Elliott and Bronson Blessington were all found guilty of the brutal rape and murder of Janine Balding. It took the jury just 2.5 hours to find them guilty on all accounts. At one side of the courtroom, Janine's mother Bev broke down in tears. Across the courtroom, Blessington's father dropped his head. In the wake of the verdict, National Party MPs called for the return of the death penalty. Castlereagh MP Roger Wotton said that the convicted 3 were nothing more than animals and said that they should be executed for their crime. Parks MP Michael Cobb was applauded when he announced during a New South Wales National Party conference that he was unapologetically in favour of hanging in cases such as this one, quote, but I don't think it will ever be brought back to this country. Sadly, because I think the majority of politicians on all sides are against it, end quote, he said. The trio were scheduled to be sentenced by Justice Newman on the 17th of September. According to Elliot's lawyer, Peter Boder, he should be allowed to stay at a juvenile institution for at least 12 months after his sentencing because he was not emotionally mature enough to cope with a maximum security prison. Quote, he would have to opt out either by killing himself or adopting a very tough image, end quote, argued Newman. Dr. Peter Irons, a senior counsellor and officer in charge at Blacktown Community Youth Centre, said that the inmates were, quote, waiting for Elliot to get in there, end quote. Justice Newman sentenced all 3 to life in prison and marked their files never to be released. quote, to sentence people so young to long terms of imprisonment is of course a heavy task. However, the facts surrounding the commission of this murder are so barbaric that I believe I have no alternative, end quote, said Justice Newman in the Supreme Court. The courtroom applauded the decision. The only relative of any of the three killers in attendance was Blessington's father. Justice Newman ordered that Elliot remain at a juvenile institution until he was 19 years old, and that Blessington remain at a juvenile institution until he was 18 years old. It was only the third time in New South Wales criminal history that a judge recommended that a killer never be released.
To go through all these court hearings and then to finally hear the jury come back and have a guilty verdict, in a way, somehow justifies all the hard work that went into this case. It was very, very difficult investigation on many levels.
Just the following year, both Jamieson and Elliot appealed their convictions, claiming that they were both innocent. Blessington had appealed his conviction but abandoned the appeal. Jamieson's lawyer, Michael Green, maintained that it was another shorty who participated in the rape and murder, not his client. Green said that following the conviction, he had a record of interview wherein Jamieson allegedly confessed to the crime examined by linguistic experts who believed that the words used were not those of Jamieson. Their appeals were denied. In 1997, Jamieson applied for an inquiry into his conviction, claiming that his confession was manufactured by police. Justice Bruce James told the Supreme Court that Jamieson had denied confessing to the murder, but claimed he had signed papers in September of 1988 without knowing what they were. The record of interview was examined by Andrew Lowry using the stylometric test, and he concluded that the words used on tape were not those of Jamieson. He suggested that the words attributed to Jamieson by police had more than one author and should not be accepted as authentic. Lowry argued that Jamieson had an extremely low IQ, and the detailed answers in his confession could not have come from him. Justice Bruce James refused the application and said that he wouldn't direct an inquiry unless there was further evidence. The following year, Wilmot, who had been released in 1996, was arrested for attempting to abduct a 20-year-old woman at knife point as she parked her car at Glenfield Railway Station. The attempted abduction was eerily similar to the abduction of Janine 10 years prior. The woman managed to escape after she got hold of his knife during a scuffle and sliced his face. While the judge had determined that Wilmot had an inactive role in Janine's rape and murder, after he was arrested for this foiled kidnapping, it was revealed that since his release, he had been convicted of 10 sexual assaults. Today, Wilmot is still behind bars and is a serial sex offender. In 2014, he was charged with raping other inmates. He was described by a forensic psychiatrist as untreatable. In 2002, New South Wales Legislative Council MP Peter Breen announced that he had uncovered evidence that could clear Jamieson. Breen said that he had spent 50 hours speaking with inmates and believed that Mark Wells was the real shorty involved in the murder of Janine. He implored the New South Wales Innocence Project to investigate forensic evidence from the case. According to Breen, the headscarf used to bind Janine belonged to Wells. He also said that a pair of shoes worn by Jamieson on the day of the murder would prove that he was not there. It was determined that there was not enough DNA on the headscarf. Neither Jamieson or Wells' DNA was found on a rectal swab. In 2006, Carol Arrow broke her 18-year silence to say that Jamieson was the shorty who killed Janine. She said she had made the dramatic statement for the sake of Janine's family. In 2016, Janine's mother Bev passed away. She was buried in a plot next to her daughter. Her father, Kerry, still lives in the home that Janine grew up in.
Detectives went bent over backwards for us. Every little item that come up, they told us, they rang us and told us.
Yes, the homicide police were wonderful, you know. We've virtually made friends with some of them today that we still receive Christmas cards from and the odd phone call from time to time, and they've been really wonderful. They were wonderful at the time. They were very kind and good to us and helped us out as best they could at the court, and that was a great support.
Common factors that can lead to violence in youths include family rejection, physical and emotional abuse, hopelessness, exploitation, and prolonged periods in juvenile detention centres. It's said that sometimes these youths can represent a ticking time bomb. In the wake of the murder of Janine Balding, the focus was predominantly on the reinstation of the death penalty, instead of looking at why such a horrific crime had occurred and what could be done to prevent it in the future. Instead of calling for youngsters to be executed when they finally blow up, adults need to take better control of the situations unfolding in their homes, and more positive programs for juvenile delinquents need to be implemented. If such measures had been taken before the youths in this case turned to a life of crime on the streets, then would Janine still be alive? Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Lynn Burnett, Kayla Megan Nutter, and Carlos Vasquez. I've almost hit my Patreon goal, and when I do, I'll be making Patreon exclusive Morbidology episodes, so check that out. I'd also like to thank everybody who's taken the time to leave a positive review or a rating on iTunes or wherever else you listen, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support, so thank you. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. We have a podcast promotion at the end of this episode for the amazing true crime podcast, Crime Salad, so please stay tuned for that. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Hey, true crime fans, this is Ashley and Ricky from Crime Salad, a true crime podcast delivering a healthy portion of crime every Friday. If you have an interest in true crime or you're looking for your next podcast to binge, tune in each week as we take you through a 20-minute murder mystery story and reveal jaw-dropping details of what investigators find along the way. Be a Crime Salad investigator with us by listening to Crime Salad at work or on your daily commute. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts by searching Crime Salad. Hope to see you there.